Well, yesterday morning, as I was going about my morning routine, the sun was out and shining, and the air wasn't quite as chilly as it is this morning. And my youngest daughter was outside kind of looking at creation and enjoying the sunshine. And I asked her what she was doing, and she was kind of looking at the nature in our backyard, and we have a family of squirrels in our backyard, maybe as many as 10 squirrels. And she says, I'm watching the squirrels, Dad, and you see that one right there? That's an albino squirrel, which, by the way, I looked up on Google this morning, and they're rare but apparently growing phenomenon here in the Columbus area and around North America. It was an all-white squirrel, no color, and the rest of the squirrels were chasing around for some reason, and two or three at a time, he was scurrying around up and down the tree from branch to branch. He could not get away, and my daughter says, man, this squirrel cannot get a break. Just bullied by all these other squirrels. And I thought about that, especially in light of the situation that's facing us today in the world. And I thought, isn't this true? A microcosm, really, of the fracture and the disunity that's taking place across our country over the last several days. You know, there are a lot of things that can potentially divide us, whether it's race or economics or politics or position or religion, whatever it is, there are a lot of things that can divide us. And there certainly is a real potential, even within the church, given the coronavirus and whatever position you have on social distancing and masks, it can be a touch point for significant division among God's people. But I find it not just interesting, I find it significant that not only is this perhaps one of the greatest times in modern history for division, this is also perhaps the greatest opportunity that the church has to showcase the gospel by demonstrating a spirit of peace and unity. The power of God working in your heart and life, calling you to peace, and calling you to be a peacemaker with the people that God has put in your path. This is something that Jesus had on his mind the night before the cross. As he should be thinking about himself and all the trouble that he would be experiencing, he's thinking and praying for his disciples. And in John chapter 17, we find a very significant prayer of Jesus, perhaps, I think the longest prayer recorded of Jesus in all of the New Testament. And Jesus has on his mind this very topic, the topic of unity. In John chapter 17, verse 11, he says this, Jesus is praying to the Father, I am no longer in the world, but they are in the world, and I am coming to you, Holy Father. Keep them in your name, which you have given to me, that they may be one, even as we are one. And then a few verses later, in verse 20, Jesus says this, I don't ask for these only, but also for those who will believe in me through their word. He's praying for us now, those who are coming to him by faith, that they may all be one, just as you, Father, are in me, and I in you, that they also may be in us, so that the world may believe that you have sent me. The glory that you have given me, I have given to them, that they may be one, even as we are one. Now, I want you to just recognize the significance of this before we move into our text, that Jesus is calling attention to the fact that if, in fact, we are in him, if, in fact, we are put in him because of faith and salvation, there is going to be something true about our lives. It's not only going to lead to unity with Jesus and unity with the Father, it's going to lead to unity among his people. But it is not unity at the compromise of truth, because in the same context, he prays in verse 17, sanctify them by your truth, your word is truth. You see, the scripture, the truth we find in the Bible is sometimes divisive, perhaps, but it's intended to draw us into the kind of unity that God desires for us to have, to guide us and to compel us to the kind of unity that will be lasting and substantial. How is it achieved? Well, this morning I want to take a look at how unity is achieved in a very practical way as we look at this story in Nehemiah chapter 5. As you remember, the people are working on this wall, this master project. It's already been at least a month since Nehemiah has been back in Jerusalem, and already the wall is built to half its height. We encountered in chapter 4 multiple times of adversity and opposition where the enemies are coming and accumulating, by the way. But at every point, it leads to greater unity among the people as they are meeting this common objective. But now as we come to chapter 5, all of that is about ready to fall apart. It's about ready to fracture because of the disunity that's taking place among the people of Israel. The Jews of influence and the Jews of power and wealth are taking advantage of their less advantaged brothers. Let me read this passage. We're going to be in verses 1 to 6 of chapter 5. Let me read this by way of context, and then we'll take it a piece at a time. Here's what it says, Nehemiah chapter 5, verses 1 to 6. Now there arose a great outcry of the people and of their wives against their Jewish brothers. For there were those who said, "With our sons and daughters we are many, so let us get grain, that we may eat and keep alive." There were also those who said, "We are mortgaging our fields, our vineyards, and our houses to get grain because of the famine." And there were those who said, "We have borrowed money for the king's tax on our fields and our vineyards. Now our flesh is as the flesh of our brothers. Our children are as their children. Yet we are forcing our sons and our daughters to be their slaves. And some of our daughters have already been enslaved. But it is not in our power to help it. For other men have our fields and our vineyards." I was very angry when I heard their outcry and these words. There is great potential, as you can see, for explosive division to take place. And this was a critical time in the history of this people, at a crucial moment of the building of these walls. Nehemiah is coming to help these people rebuild this great project. And now we find this division that's beginning to percolate. Maybe you wonder, why in the world is this coming to a head at this point now? Why Nehemiah? Why are they coming to him? Certainly this is an issue that has been around for quite some time already. Look at all of the water under the bridge. They certainly raised this issue before. But maybe the work on the walls have compounded the problem as now they're working shoulder to shoulder with some of these very people who have taken advantage of them. And maybe accounts were coming due. It's already been about a month, and this happens to be the time of the harvest. This is the end of the fifth month, and the fifth and sixth month are the times of the harvest. And as dads are in the city of Jerusalem, dads and older brothers are in the city of Jerusalem building these walls, they can't be home harvesting fields. And so the desperation begins to accumulate. They have been in Jerusalem, and here they are at work. And they come to Nehemiah, who has only been there for about a month, maybe a little bit more than a month, but they notice that there's something quite special about him. He is a man who's distinguished himself as one who loves the Lord and one who loves the people. He's going to model in our passage today an individual who pursues peace for the glory of God. An individual who has on his heart the unity of God's people. Not just to help complete this project, but because he cares about the reputation of God among the nations. And over the next couple of weeks, we're going to kind of build this out and look at the details of this story and try to understand how Nehemiah goes about this process. What foundation does he have in order to levy his accusations against this wealthy class? We're going to see three points of pursuing peace this morning. We're going to see that Nehemiah loved the people deeply. We're going to see that Nehemiah listened to them impartially. And we're going to see that Nehemiah led them righteously. But let's look at this one at a time. First, Nehemiah loved these people deeply. Now, we kind of see this in the white spaces of verse 1 and in all the material kind of leading up to chapter 5. It says in verse 1, just by way of reminder, "Now there arose a great outcry of the people and of their wives against the Jewish brothers." And then in verse 6, just as a reminder, "I was very angry when I heard their outcry in these words." Nehemiah seems to be the only person in Jerusalem that cares. Certainly there were other leaders. Certainly there were other people who had the authority to do something about this problem. But Nehemiah seems to be the only person at this time that is willing to step in, willing to take notice, willing to do something about this problem. It's because Nehemiah was a person who loved these people dearly and deeply. His love shows up at the very early stages of the book of Nehemiah, and it shows up and is perhaps nurtured and prompted because of a life of prayer. He loved them first by loving them through supplication, loving them through the means of prayer. He poured himself out for these people and devoted himself to lifting up their burdens before the Lord before he even met them, before he was ever in Jerusalem. And God used this 4 months of cultivating a love for these people through prayer before he made his way to Jerusalem. And certainly, there was prayer for these people even before Nehemiah chapter 1 comes into play. But Nehemiah chapter 1 verse 4, let me just remind you of this prayer. He says, "As soon as I heard these words," and his brother Hanani came to share with him the distress that was taking place there in Jerusalem. He says, "I heard these words and I sat down and wept and mourned for days. And I continued fasting and praying before the God of heaven." Nehemiah had a heart that was already touched, already sensitive to the plight of these people. And this prayer paved the way not only for a heart that was cultivated in sensitivity for these people, but also helped to cultivate a productivity once he showed up. God was already working in the situation ahead of Nehemiah, working in the heart of King Artaxerxes to let him go, working in the hearts of the people to be receptive to his challenge, working with the situation in general as they would face opposition. The people were emboldened because of Nehemiah's prayer and faith. And prayer continues to carry this group of individuals. In chapter 4, verse 4, Nehemiah prays to God. He says, "Hear, O our God, for we are despised." In chapter 4, verse 9, he prays again. "We prayed to our God and set a guard as a protection against them day and night." Then a call to faith in verse 14. "Don't be afraid. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome." Another call to faith in verse 20. "Our God will fight for us." Might I be so bold as to say that the degree to which you pray for the people in your community is the degree to which you will love them. Because prayer is what helps to cultivate that love, that substantial love for the people that God has put in your path. And as we come to appreciate and understand that nothing will happen for them and through them unless God is the one who's making it happen. The significance of prayer. And as we consider coming and worshiping together as a body again next week and throughout the month of June and on into the future, can I encourage you to also be devoting yourself to prayer? I would even say and encourage you to pray on a daily basis for the people in your watch care. Now, if you don't know who's in your watch care, then I would encourage you to get this app. I'm going to show you this app. On the left-hand side of the screen, you'll see this is the app for our church directory. And if you don't have it already, I'd just encourage you to download it. If you don't have access to that, you can email Pastor David and he can find a way to give you access to that if you're a regular member here at Maranatha. The center panel is our family. I figured it was safest to show our family. This is how it'll show up on your screen, on your app. And if you scroll down to the bottom on the far right-hand side, you'll see the various groups that you're part of. One is your small group, and the other is your watch care group. Can I just encourage you to scroll and to navigate to that panel and to pray every day for the people in your watch care? Pray for their names, pray for them specifically. And if you don't know what to pray, I would encourage you to pray Philippians chapter 1, verses 9 to 11 for them. It says this: "It is my prayer that your love may abound more and more with knowledge and all discernment, so that you may approve what is excellent, and so be pure and blameless for the day of Christ, filled with the fruits of righteousness that come through Jesus Christ to the glory and praise of God." I would just encourage you on a daily basis to be praying through your watch care and praying this prayer for those who are closest to you. Pray that God would cultivate a love for them and their love for one another in the rest of this church. And pray that through all things, God would be glorified and praised through our corporate testimony of unity, and the gospel would shine through our lives. Nehemiah was an individual who loved deeply. We see it even before he shows up on the scene in Jerusalem. But that love for them led to this next thing. It led to sacrifice. He loved them through supplication. He also loved them through sacrifice. You know, Nehemiah gave up a high-profile job in Persia for the sake of coming to serve the people here in Jerusalem. He gave up the comforts of that life. He was a cupbearer to the king. He had a position of influence. He was hobnobbing with the most important people on the planet. He was influential in some of the biggest decisions on the world theater. Nehemiah was the guy whispering in the ear of Artaxerxes. Nehemiah had access to unlimited power and authority. He had access to all the resources that he could ever imagine or want. He had name recognition, walk down the street and say, "Hey, isn't that Nehemiah? Isn't he the cupbearer to the king?" And here he comes showing up in Jerusalem and he's a nobody. He gave that up for the sake of pursuing peace for the glory of God. He gave that up because of love for the people of Israel. He gave that up because of a passion for the glory of God, desire for his renown to be known among the nations. I'm reminded of the quote that C.H. Spurgeon often said. He said, "If God has called you to be a pastor or a Christian worker, do not stoop to be a king." And that was certainly Nehemiah's perspective. He had all the position that he could ever want, and yet he understood that service to God and love for God's people was more important. And here he is in Jerusalem, serving them, loving them, sacrificing for them. Nehemiah, we find in chapter 4, also gave up his servants, his own bodyguard, his own group of special agents, as it were. He gave them up so that they could protect others in the city. And we're going to see towards the end of this chapter, chapter 5, that Nehemiah gave up his own money to ransom and redeem those who were captives in Israel. He sacrificed his rightful salary. He provided extravagantly food at his table to feed at least 150 people on a daily basis, all on his own, at his own expense. Nehemiah was willing to give up his rights, the things that he was owed, the things that were due to him, the things that he had a right to expect and to put on the people. But because of a love for them and a love for God, he decided that he was going to withdraw those rights and serve and sacrifice the people of God. It should remind you of another person, the person of Jesus Christ, who was willing to give up his rights to come to earth, to be Emmanuel, God with us. He gave up his position in heaven and all the authority related to that. He gave up the expression of his divine attributes. He gave up for us the adoration and the praise that was given to him on a perpetual basis to come and to be criticized and condemned and then ultimately to be crucified. Jesus gave it up as an example for us, and we are meant to follow in his example, just like Nehemiah, to give up our rights for the sake of love for others around us. And then he loved them through service. Briefly, Nehemiah did not separate himself from the group. Nehemiah, although he had all this authority, although he had all this wealth, he did not separate himself from the group, but was willing to serve shoulder to shoulder with them in Jerusalem. He was willing to risk his own life, to be the center of the battle. The trumpet would blow, and Nehemiah was there in the heat of it, if that were to happen. And here he is, we'll find in our passage, a willingness for him to experience the pain that they were experiencing, to be burdened with the burdens that they encountered. He's already cultivated and endured some of the pressure already. In hearing about their distress there in Persia, he mourns and weeps. He's broken over the demise of the people in Jerusalem. And certainly as he shows up and sees it for himself, and now as he hears the situation that they're under, there is a brokenness. There is a burden that he feels for the people. Their pain was his pain. Their trouble was his trouble. Their work was his work. Just as we find in Mark chapter 10, verse 45, the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. Nehemiah was willing to serve just like the future Christ, the future Messiah. He wore on his own life, he robed himself in the same kind of attitude that God had for his people. An attitude of service and love through sacrifice, through giving up himself for them. So there's no wonder why this assembly came to Nehemiah. They saw in Nehemiah something that was truly special. And in as little as a month, Nehemiah becomes the go-to guy. And we'll find in chapter 5, verse 14, that Nehemiah is appointed governor, but I don't think he's governor yet. I think that the king, Artaxerxes, understood that his job was temporary, sent him to go build a wall and then come back. But we find that his position there in Jerusalem lasted a little longer, and I think because of the way that he endeared himself to the people. As a peacemaker who cared deeply for them. And not only did they care for him, but he cared for them. And so his mission to them lasted. Nehemiah's love for the people and his ability to lead come through front and center in our passage today. He loved them deeply. But he demonstrated that love to them through what we find in the next several verses. He loved them deeply, but he also listened to them impartially. He listened to them impartially. We find in verses 1 through 5 the account of all that is taking place among the people at this time. And we find that however inconvenient this news was and however disruptive this problem was, Nehemiah was still available. He listened and he demonstrated his willingness to listen through his availability. And that's our first subpoint. He was available. Notice at the beginning of verse 2, for there were those who said, and then at the beginning of verse 3, there were also those who said, and then at the beginning of verse 4, and there were those who said. I know this point seems obvious, but I just want to draw attention to the fact that up until now, no one seemed to care. This has been an ongoing issue for a long time, but Nehemiah seems to be the only person willing to press in, only person willing to have the time to hear out the matter. And I don't want to criticize, but where was Ezra in all of this? Ezra had come 14 years earlier. Ezra had been given authority by the king. Ezra had exercised that authority in an earlier situation. And Ezra, we'll see, shows up as soon as the walls are built to help lead the people in a spiritual way by reading the law. So he comes to exercise some sort of authority, but here he's distant. Here he's behind the scenes. We don't see Ezra. Now, maybe not because he didn't care, but But he didn't care enough to step in to the trouble like Nehemiah did. And there are at least three distinct groups of people. We're talking about this great assembly. We are given the words, there is a great outcry. The same expression is used of those living in Egypt when they were held in slavery. This great outcry against the Egyptians because of the oppression that they experienced. That means that this was a widespread issue. It was a deep issue. It touched on the very nerve of the people, the very fabric of family and survival. The problem was great. The men were joined by their wives. You get a sense that the drawing attention to the fact that the toll that it was taking on the entire family. There was work to do, though. There was a wall to be built. It was only done to half its height. This was not a convenient time for an interruption. The labor force is now managing efforts on two fronts. First, in helping to prepare for combat, and the other, to continue the work of construction. This was the last thing that Nehemiah needed at a time like this. But why now? As I said, this was the time of the harvest. And as families are struggling to bring in the harvest and to make the necessary income for survival, their husbands and brothers and older men are here in Jerusalem. Accounts are coming due. And the pocketbook has become very tight. Nehemiah understands the significance of this issue, and he loves the people. They have his attention. He's willing to put his work aside for the sake of listening to the people, and listening in an impartial way. I mean, he could have said, come on, these guys are poor, they're not worth my time. Or he could have said, oh, they made some bad decisions. I mean, they're living with the trouble that they've created for themselves. Why should I care? But he doesn't say this. He doesn't say, let's deal with this later. He doesn't say, I have more important things to do right now. He doesn't say, get over it. He doesn't say, stop pestering me. Instead, his love for God and his love for the people says, okay, right now this is the most important thing for me to hear. Because Nehemiah loves peace. He is available for the people to listen. But he was also attentive. He was available, but also attentive. Now, maybe for those of you like me, you're driving in the car and you see two or three people in the car and they're talking, but they're not talking to each other. Everyone's either on their own phone or on their own device, and there's no communication taking place between them. That's not what Nehemiah is doing here. He's not just sitting there letting them spill their guts while he's doing his own Instagramming of the account. He was willing to give them undivided attention. He listened thoroughly. It didn't matter that this group was financially bankrupt. It didn't matter that they had nothing to offer him. There was nothing in it for Nehemiah. There's no opportunity of future remuneration. Nehemiah did this because he loved the people. And we see at least three groups here. The first group is in verse 2. There were those, it says, who said, with our sons and our daughters, we are many. So let us get grain that we may eat and keep alive. These were the individuals who had no property. They were tradesmen, perhaps even shepherds. Maybe they were merchants and buying and selling and trading. But now things have been cut off. Because of the hostility and opposition all around Jerusalem, and every single group that they would have traded with have shut them down and have become their adversaries, now they have no access to income. And compounded by the fact of their large families, there is very little, if any, access to money, and thus no access to grain. They are starving. They're desperate. They need help. They are belabored by this situation of building in Jerusalem. The second group is in verse 3. There were those also who said, we are mortgaging our fields, our vineyards, and our houses to get grain because of the famine. Some had used their property as a means of collateral. So they had taken a second mortgage so they could buy enough bread for their families. And in so doing, they had hoped to be able to pay off their debts, but now the famine had come. Their crops were not producing the kind of yield that they needed to produce, and so the bankruptcy that they had led to further bankruptcy. And now they were completely desperate, because all of their future legacy, the inheritance that they would pass on to the next generation, was beginning to evaporate from their fingers, from their midst. They had debts. The debts were coming due. It was clear that this year of harvest was going to be a bad one. They weren't going to be able to turn this around. Everything was upside down for them. And they come and ask Nehemiah to weigh in, to intervene. Please help. The third group we find in verses 4 and 5. This group also has property. It says, there were those who said, we have borrowed money for the king's tax on our fields and our vineyards. Now our flesh is as the flesh of our brothers, and our children are as their children. Yet we are forcing our sons and our daughters to be slaves. And some of our daughters have already been enslaved. But it is not in our power to help, for other men have our fields and our vineyards. This group, instead of mortgaging their fields, have decided that they're going to use there's a part of the law that gave them the opportunity to have their kids be hired hands, to be debt servants until the debt was paid or until the year of Jubilee. This was totally appropriate in the spirit of the law. But what was taking place is those who had the ability were taking advantage of these individuals, taking their sons, taking their daughters, and using them for their own benefit, and raising taxes against them, creating interest so that they could not pay back the debt. It was a difficult situation. And Nehemiah understood what was at stake. The unity of the people was at stake. The identity of God among the nations, his glory among the peoples. It can be really easy to jump to conclusions. It can be really easy for Nehemiah to evaluate the scene in front of him and to try to wonder why in the world these people were in the situation that they were in. But he's willing to listen, and he's willing to evaluate in a way that is God-exalting. It leads Nehemiah to act. It leads him to act in a righteous way. And that's where we go next. We're going to develop this for ourselves a little bit more next week. But I want to just draw your attention to three points briefly. I want you to see in verse 6, and it follows through the end of the passage, and we're going to look at this over the next couple of weeks, and we'll touch on them as we go. But I want you to see that Nehemiah acts righteously, and he leads in a way that exemplifies the purity and holiness of God. First, he responds emotionally in verse 6. He says, I was very angry when I heard their outcry in these words. To put it succinctly, Nehemiah was ticked. He was enraged by the way that these people were being taken advantage of. He is not indifferent about their situation. He's not unwilling to show a vested interest in what's happening here. He is personally vested. His heart breaks over the situation of these people. He sees the injustice, and it infuriates him. This is a response of godliness. This is a response of one who has wept and prayed over the distress of these people. This is a response of one who loves the unity of God's people and has a passion for the glory of God among the nations. So united is he to this group, so bound in a common objective and interest, so burdened is he in prayer for them that he breaks over their situation and it affects him personally. He is one who is willing to rejoice with those who rejoice and to weep with those who weep. He feels as if this trouble that has happened to these brothers has happened to him. He does take it personally because he sees the glory of God is at stake here. He responds emotionally. His heart breaks with their plight. He demonstrates a heart of God for the people. But he also responds biblically. We see that in verses 7 and 9. He says, I took counsel with myself, which means he didn't fly off the handle. He didn't allow this rage inside of him to manifest itself in ungodliness. He took counsel with himself. He took a step back. He was willing to be emotionally affected, but not to respond in a way that was inappropriate. He took counsel with himself. He brought charges against the nobles and the officials. He said to them, you are exacting interest from each other. And I held a great assembly against them. Like I said, we'll develop this some more as we go and look at the passages of Scripture that guided Nehemiah in his assessment of the situation. He got his direction and his guidance from the Word. He was able to apply knowledge to this specific situation because of his understanding of the law. And he has a love for the glory of God. We see that in verse 9. So I said, the thing that you are doing is not good. Ought you not to walk in the fear of our God, to prevent the taunts of the nations, our enemies? You're no better than them. We expect them to act this way, but you're those who call yourself followers of God. You are those who are children of God, set apart by God. You are meant to be a holy people, a kingdom of priests, as we find in Exodus chapter 19. But instead, you are acting just like them, and you are besmirching the testimony of God among the nations. Partial obedience, and there was some obedience here, but partial obedience was disobedience and dishonor to God. And we'll look at that more in the weeks to come. Nehemiah is interested and guided biblically. He applies the standard equitably and impartially to this situation. He's driven emotionally. He responds biblically. And finally, we'll see in a couple of weeks from now that he responds consistently. He loves these people. He doesn't apply a standard to that he's not unwilling to apply to himself. And we'll see in verses 14 to 19 that Nehemiah was not a hypocrite. He was one who was willing to step in and love the people in a very tangible way. We'll see that he didn't demand the food allowance that he was entitled to in verse 14. He didn't take a salary in verse 15. He didn't let his servants wield any kind of superiority over the people in verse 15. He worked alongside the people, we see in verse 16. He didn't purchase any land. He didn't take away any of their inheritance, like those who were robbing individuals of their fields and their vineyards. He was interested in their legacy. He didn't take advantage of the opportunity. And in verse 17, he fed 150 people every single day at his own expense. Nehemiah was a person who applied the standard to his life consistently. He lived as a model of a person who pursued peace to the glory of God. We have in these days an opportunity to set ourselves apart from the world, an opportunity to showcase the gospel, a chance for us to allow the world to see that the gospel can have a potent effect in our lives. It can lead us to unity. It can help us to lay down those preferences that we might have and to love the others that God has put in our path for the sake of the glory of God, in the image and renown of God among our community, among Columbus, and around the world. May God help us as we seek to showcase the glory of God through peace in unity. Let me pray. Oh God, we thank you for the example of Nehemiah. Thank you for the testimony of his willingness to listen, to be available, to not make determinations on the surface, but a willingness to ask questions, a willingness to press in, a willingness to devote attention to hearing out the matter, and then weighing those matters from a biblical standpoint and applying that precedent, that standard to his own life. Father, I pray that you would help us in the in the months and weeks, the weeks and months that are before us, to be willing to showcase the gospel through our commitment to gospel living, allowing the Holy Spirit to have his way in our lives, and to create unity and peace among the people of God. Help us in this endeavor, we pray, in Jesus' name, amen. God bless you. Look forward to seeing you all next week. Hope you have a good week together.